Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's a great bit of kit, as you know. I love it. It's also good for the environment, though. It uses less power than a kettle, as once it's boiled the water, it keeps it hot through the technology of a vacuum. No idea how this works, but apparently it does. My head can't work it out, so I'll have to ask them one day to draw a diagram for me on the back of an envelope or something. Anyway, go to cooker.co.uk for more information and to see the different models. They've got some rascal models now. Fantastic models out there. Fit every kitchen. Love it. Today's hour is 15 questions to Paul Brunson. Well, I say 15 questions. I mean, I think all the regular listeners will know that. I'll be lucky if I get 5 or 6 questions asked. You know, it's just a conversation, but every now and then ask them a little question. Pretend it's a format. People like a format, don't they? So I don't know whether I ever got close to asking anyone 15 questions. I'm not sure. I know Charlie Higson went to me, "What? You're not doing all 15? But I've looked at all the questions and I've got answers to all 15. Well, I kind of like to keep this podcast an hour. And I don't have more than an hour to spend listening to crap from my mouth, so why would anyone else? So that's an hour, well, just over sometimes and just shy other times. I hope you're still enjoying them anyway. Today's is going to be good, actually. I'm really looking forward to it. Paul Brunson. Paul Brunson is a TV host. He's a serial entrepreneur, television host and columnist whose speciality lies in teaching others professional and social skills. An internationally recognized expert in interpersonal relationships, personal development, and entrepreneurship. He currently serves as a featured business columnist for USA Today, co-host of UK Celebs Go Dating television show. That's kind of where I know him from because I've interviewed him a few times on Sunday Brunch. Always comes across as a very smart man and knows his onions. I follow him on social media as well. He says some wise things. I'm going to talk to him about that. Knows a lot about relationships. He's also the host of his podcast, Better with Paul. His firm has served over 600 clients directly and has matched over 6,000 individuals on dates collectively through the inventive live events and social media. I think he used to organize these absolutely huge speed dating events and things like that. It's going to pair people up. But he's studied relationships for a long time, and I think he has some knowledge on him. So I think it'll be quite an interest, if you're interested in relationships, that is. But I believe that relationships is one of the things which makes the world tick. I think it's important to be comfortable with being on your own. That's very important. Life, as you know, is a one-player game. It's not a multiplayer. It can involve multiplayers, but it is a one-player game. And so it's important. But then building relationships with other people is equally as important. And I suppose avoiding the bad ones, getting that toxic crap out of your life, is probably the most important life skill that we never learn. Let's meet him. He's Paul. Hi, Paul. How are you?
You know, Tim, I'm feeling great. Great Good. Today.
Oh, great well, that's today. That's great news. What are you up to at the moment this week? What have you been doing?
So this week, a lot of end of year children school stuff.
Yeah.
Which I will say is wild because in the States, when my boys went to school, they would be out of school by now. You know, right. By June, early June, they're out of school. But here, you know, they're going to school basically until August.
it's called free childcare. So, what I love actually about following you on Instagram is you look at the positives of the UK, things like our gun control and our NHS and stuff like that. And I really love it when Americans, because you can get really down on your country and then someone like you comes and starts talking it up. And I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. It's really nice that I live here.
This is, all right, Tim. So this is where I know I'm going to sound like I'm going left. The UK is paradise. The UK is paradise. And I know a lot of people will disagree, but just let's take a snapshot of what's going on in my home country, the US, right now. We literally just had testimony of a president who strangled his Secret Service because he wanted to go to an insurrection. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a totally different place.
Yeah, exactly right. And it seems like a bit of a, I don't know whether it's right or not, but it feels like it's boiling over in America at the moment. Is that correct? Do you think that?
It feels very much so. I've never had more people inquiring from me about how to move out of the US. That's the number one kind of DM that I get or email that I get is, Paul, how did you do it? How do we move? But you think about just kind of the big highlights of the U.S., you know, you have obviously the abortion laws, or should I say abortion now has been struck down, right? Yeah. You have a thought that Donald Trump is going to win the next election, right? You have a terrible economy, you know, in terms of inflation. You have corporations now controlling the U.S. unlike, you know, probably any other country in the world. It's just not good.
I mean, things aren't all that rosy over here at the moment, but though if you do get ill, it's free, and I just think that is just the best thing ever. And anyone who is avoiding their taxes, I hate you, because pay in, because this is the one thing why it's worth paying. Everyone always thinks when they're paying their taxes they're paying for, I don't know, refugees or something, and they get angry about it, or other people's drains or something. You know, you're paying for the NHS, and it's worth every single penny. The fact that if you get ill, you know, and don't, when you pay your taxes, if you are listening to this, you don't pay your taxes, think of old people and kids getting ill. Think about that rather than all the other stuff which is clouding your mind. They might not spend the taxes in the best possible way, but a percentage of them goes on that, and so it's worth it. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tim. I agree.
Good. And the other thing that I find that's what I love, but I also find it annoying on your Instagram is the fact that you've traveled our country extensively, and you've inspired me. Actually, I'm going on holiday to Scotland this year with my daughter. I was watching you do it, and I was thinking, rather than go like on a plane, why don't I just go around our country? And it's just you and your wife and your two boys. You look like you had such a beautiful time traveling Britain.
I tell you, traveling all of the UK, and we also, you know, in this last road trip we went to Ireland, was a life-changing experience. You know, I found before the trip, I found out that a lot of my DNA comes from the Highlands of Scotland.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I've got to go. And I found my clan, the Brunton clan. So not Brunson, like my last name, but Brunton. So we were able to find that and find the tartan, you know, that goes with the clan. But it was magical. Not only the culture with regard to like the art and the history, but the foods. know, how different the foods are in each region. The use of, I never knew a potato could be used so many ways. Like, God, you can do everything with a potato, everything. Yeah, so it was good. It was really good.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Right, let's get on with some of these questions, and then we'll come back and work our way through an hour here. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh, man. Make your own memories. Don't feel like you have to live the expectation of others. You know, I'm in a heavy place, Tim, because I had a really good friend of mine is in a coma. Another good friend of mine just passed away, and it's made me just reflect a lot. And I've just read this book by Bronnie Ware on the top regrets that people who have died, you know, have had right before their death. And that's number one. Number one is people feeling like they're living the expectation of others opposed to living how they truly want to live. You know, so that's my advice is live that way. And to help you do that, I have a new rule, Tim. I mean, I haven't written about this, but this is something I've been thinking about is, so my friend who passed away was 7 years older than me. And I thought to myself, you know, we often hear people say, well, what would you do if you only had a week to live, or you only had a month or a year? Well, you'd probably do something outrageous because you had such a short amount of time. But if you knew you had 7 years, you might do things a little bit differently than if you had a year to live. You know what I mean? You would feel better investing your time and energy into people and things and experiences. So I guess the long story short is live like you have 7 years left. You know, that's how I'm approaching it. I think when you do that, you focus more so on living your life opposed to the expectations of others.
That's great. I always say, think about death every day enable you to live, because one day it's over. So assume that. And every day something, there'll be the last time you do something with your kids this time, the last time you change a nappy, or the last time you do something. So everything's always sort of slowly dying, and you've got to realize that to enable yourself to live, I feel. And I think 7 years is a good idea, really good idea. But what worries me, Paul, is then people start going, I'm going to make a bucket list. And the other thing in that book is that life is about relationships. So, okay, so you go, I need to go to, I don't know what it is, what's something, I need to surf in Hawaii. That's only worthwhile if you're sharing it with someone, maybe. I mean, you can do it on your own. I do believe that thing, but the bucket list, I think, is a bit of a modern thing, which is, I'm not sure it's the best way of living your life. I think the best way of looking at your life is looking around like you seem to have such an amazing relationship with your children and your wife. It's like, oh God, it's amazing. And I think you've really worked on that, haven't you?
Oh yeah. No. And you know what? I'm with you on the bucket list. I not, you know, this is where we are completely eye to eye. I don't talk much about it. I actually despise bucket lists. I despise them. And it's for that exact reason, is because people write the bucket list just to check it off, just to say it's done, opposed to staying in the moment. You know, a lot of people feel a certain way about Eckhart Tolle, right? But he wrote The Power of Now, right? And talks about how, you know, how do you experience a moment? And I agree with his whole philosophy. And that is that if you are going to Hawaii to surf, right? You know, whatever it is, the key is, in that particular moment, do you learn anything, right? What is the lesson? Because if you're not learning anything, then you're not actually experiencing the moment. So that's one, is there a lesson? And then two is, can you then teach that lesson to someone else? So have you grasped enough of what's happening in the moment so that you can share that with someone else? If you could do those two things, you're actually living in the moment, in that particular moment. So whatever it is you're doing, if it's by yourself, if it's with someone, if it's with a loved one, if it's whatever it is, ask yourself, well, what, let me just stop and pause. What can I learn? Good, bad, or indifferent? And then how can I teach this at least to one other person? That's living in the moment. And if we're doing more of that, then we are living.
Yeah. I remember traveling around America once. I just arrived in America and thought, oh, I'll travel around for a while, see what goes on. And I had literally no plans. Arrived in LA, ended up in San Francisco. Then I heard about these things called driveways where you drive student cars along. So I drove to Chicago, ended up in Chicago, met some Americans, some Australians, went up to Canada, stayed in Toronto, ended up living with some people in Toronto, then came back down, went to New York, and I was in a hostel in New York, and this person walked in, couple of people walked in, and they looked absolutely exhausted, and they were from Britain. I said, how are you guys? And they were like, oh, we're exhausted. I said, why? And they go, we're on this coach where you spend 1 day to 2 days in every city in America, and we're doing the whole of America. And I'm like,
oh my God.
And how long? And they're like, a month. I'm like, Jesus Christ, how long are you in New York for? They said 2 days. And I'm like, they look absolutely exhausted. And I went, that is the worst idea I've ever heard. But they were doing that thing of ticking. I've been there, I've been there, I've been there, I've been there, I've been there. And all that is to boast to somebody else. You're not actually living it, are you?
You're not living it. You know, I just read, because Tim, you know, I'm super nerd. I'm one of the biggest nerds on the planet. So I do read a lot of research studies. There was a study I was reading last week, and it was fascinating. It was about how we use social media. And basically, you know, over 90% of people now they capture images. So say they're on that tour, right, of New York for 2 days. They're in New York for 2 days, but what they're doing is they're taking photos so that they can then post those photos, so that they can then share those photos. And the issue is that when you are taking an image specifically to just share, right? It's all about how do I look so that I can share this? Then you derive zero satisfaction in that. Opposed to taking an image that you are in the moment of, right? It's a lesson. Oh my God, look at how the Statue of Liberty sways. I had no idea that when you go up the Statue of Liberty that it sways. By the way, my wife was freaked out when she saw that for the first time because, you know, I'm from New York. So I brought her to the Statue of Liberty. And when you walk up the Statue of Liberty, literally it sways because it has to sway because of the wind. So if you then say, okay, I'm going to take this video just to see how it sways. This is cool. And you're doing it for you then derive the highest level of satisfaction. And then if you want to post that later, that's fine, right? But once again, I think this goes back to the point of if we are not in these moments, we are going to be living miserable lives. And to your point of we're slowly dying, think about how sad that is to be living in an unsatisfied way and be slowly dying at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, that's sad. So we have to spin that.
Yeah.
You have to spin it.
All right, next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Oh, man. I hope it's yet to come.
Yeah. you ended up on Oprah for a while, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, that was, that was awesome and cool. But, you know, it's like, how do you describe best? Because... I was, man, Tim, I was Oprah, so I was nervous the whole time, you know, so I was freaked out the whole time. I was not having a good time because I was scared the whole time.
How did you end up on that? What's your career, trajectory? Oh, I can't say the word. What's the direction of your career trajectory? That's the word I'm looking for. How did you end up on Oprah?
Oh man, it was, the short answer is when my wife and I started our matchmaking agency in 2008, we then created a YouTube series called The Modern Day Matchmaker. Mm-hmm. And I always joke and say, look, nobody watched this thing. As a matter of fact, you could go to YouTube right now and Modern Day Matchmaker probably has, you know, 100 views. It's like, there's no views on it. But every week we would put out these videos and it turned out that Oprah was one of the people watching this video.
Brilliant.
And she invited me into to LA, flew me from New York to LA, and invited me right on the spot to co-host a TV show with her, which is just surreal, you know? And so I ended up doing a television show with Oprah simultaneous to launching my matchmaking business. So doing those two at the same time, of course, like Oprah says, you know, this is what you, Oprah says, you're a duck, you know, whatever it is. And so she was like, this guy's a legitimate matchmaker. He's great. And he's more than a matchmaker. You know, he's a life coach. And so, so we did the show. The show was the largest social experiment ever in the history of TV. And it was called Love Town. So I did that project with her, launched the business at the same time. The business starts to take off. So we're growing. We become one of the biggest matchmaking agencies in the United States. And then I continue to do television projects. So I'm doing television projects, and I consider TV to be never a full-time job. Matter of fact, not until the last couple of months did I consider TV to be full-time. Yeah. I always thought it was the icing on the cake, but the cake was running businesses. And so I then did that, you know, launched several businesses. We grew our matchmaking agency, sold our agency. The biggest business, though, that I've ever been a part of is a school that I co-founded in Washington, D.C. So we co-founded this school in 2012, 2013. And it is a private graduate school, private college. And we also are launching private high school. So I guess like senior school here in the UK. And we have the largest MBA program in Washington, D.C. So it's a massive school. You know, wow. We have over 1,000 students. So that's the biggest kind of project I've been a part of. But I've invested in tons of companies, been advisor to a ton of companies, because before matchmaking, I was in finance. Right. So I was an investment banker, and then I managed money for a family. So finance is my background, and I kind of fell into the matchmaking. So my career is all over the place.
What skills are involved in the matchmaking then? Were you doing huge events, weren't you? Speed dating events and things like that.
Yeah. At one point we were the biggest speed dating company in the world. We were, but we did it all for matchmaking. So we started with just myself and my wife, and we were literally, I call it hand to hand. Tim, you would come to me and say, "Hey, Paul, I'm looking for somebody who looks like ABC." And I would say, "Okay." And I would hop in my car and start driving around looking for the person that looked like ABC. Like, I'm talking about, because this is 2008, you know, Instagram is not here yet. Facebook is here, but people aren't really using it. MySpace was still around. It was a different time. So a lot of our matchmaking was done by literally eyeing the person. My wife and I would watch television looking for people who we thought fit the persona type. So a matter of fact, one of our most successful matches was a school. He was a school principal, and he was talking about how he loved his kids, and he was on the evening news. We saw him. We said, "Oh, he's perfect for one of our clients," right? So we found the school, went to the school, you know, tracked him down, made the introduction. So it was very slow-moving, non-technology, you know, usage. And then slowly, we started leveraging technology. We started introducing big events like our flow dating event. We started introducing therapy services. We got to it wasn't massive staff, but we had 12 full-time, staff members. So then by 2015, we sold the business because it was super successful. And what I've learned about finances is when, you know, you sell at the top, you don't want to sell at the bottom.
Yeah.
So we sold that. But that particular business I loved. And the skills necessary for matchmaking, in my opinion, is it's about being a super geek and super nerd, right? You know? And
See, what worries me now is we've got into the world of technology and the digital age as it is, and a lot of dates are happening that way, and we're mammals, and I think mammals use their sense of smell a lot. I know people mask it a lot with perfume. I actually did a podcast with a guy called Robert Wigley the other day, who wrote a book, Bored and Digital, The Story of the Distracted Generation. And in it, there's a fact that on dating sites, 50% of the people on there are lying. So that's half of them. I mean, my maths is good enough to work out that's half of them. And you're like, geez. So, and you know, when you meet someone, you find them attractive even by the way they move or the way they hold themselves or there's something about them. And I worry that with the idea that everybody's dating via apps, that we are trying to put people together who aren't really that compatible. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so based on my research, I'd say it's closer to 80, 90% of people lie on dating apps.
I just can't see the point in doing that. But anyway, go on.
But yeah, but think about it, like even the smallest thing. So, you know, they'll, you know, take their age down by a year, you know, yeah. They'll take their height up by half an inch, you know, they'll take their weight down by whatever. Like, so almost everyone, right, is to a certain extent. We just have to accept that. But your point is absolutely correct, is that we determine attraction by a multitude of things.
Yeah.
Scent is one, body movement is one, right? You have tone of voice is another. You know, one of the most powerful studies ever done on pheromones, right, talking about scent, was called the, have you heard about this?
This, no.
This white, it's called the white, I think you would like this, Tim.
Yeah.
Is what they did is they took a bunch of guys and put them in white t-shirts.
Yeah.
And they kind of worked them out a little bit, you know, and they got sweaty, right? And what they, then they took those shirts and they brought those to a bunch of women, a bunch of ladies, and they had the ladies to sniff the shirts, uh-huh. right? To determine, was there one person that they kind of, you know, leaned towards, et cetera, right? So they did that. That was one control group. Then they let the ladies see the people, right? Without the scent, right? That's in a second group. Then the third group is they let them see, they let them interact with them so they could see them and smell them, right? They found that that second group that was only able to see visually were completely off, right? Completely off. They went with what they considered to be standards of beauty. But those who were able to see and smell perfectly aligned with those who could smell, which means that the pheromones were the indicator, right? That was the key. And so your point is valid. Now, what we also have to accept is that we're living in a completely different day and age, and technology now is going to be it. I literally track our usage of dating apps. And if you look at the percentage of people who meet their spouse on a dating app today in the UK and the US, it's roughly 80%. So 80% of people now meet their spouse through a dating app or through, like, you know, Facebook or Instagram, that kind of thing. Whereas just 10 years ago, it was less than 50%. Hmm. 10 years ago, it was, you know, work was high. You go back 20, 30 years ago, it was church was high. Family introductions was high on the list, right? Where that number is going is I see it going close to 100%. So what that means is that A, we have to accept that there will be issues in the connections. Secondly, is technology now needs to catch up. So you're going to see, and I've seen dating apps that try to introduce, they can't introduce scent, but they try to introduce body movement, you know, metaverse type dating.
Yeah.
You know, they try to introduce touch. I've seen like hologram dating and all kinds of crazy stuff. So it is going to be a challenge, and we just have to account for that when we are dating.
Hmm. Have you ever read Anzi Zanzari's book on dating? It's a great book, yeah. Isn't it? The sort of conclusion to that book, I don't know whether you got the same one from as I did. It's basically people used to marry because it was a convenience, and then they fell in love. So they live like five blocks from each other, and one of them had some money and was working. The other one was able to bring up some kids, and then they fell in love because a lot of them used to talk about loving their husbands and wives, whereas now we marry for love. And then 5 years later or 7 years later, whenever the itch is, we go, ah, no, what's around the corner? What's next?
What's next? Yeah.
Divorce rate's high, isn't it? And I think it can only get higher with the way we're dating now, maybe.
No. So Tim, the divorce rate is actually decreasing.
Oh.
The divorce rate in the UK and the US is actually decreasing. A lot of people don't know about this, right? But it's decreasing. But the reason why it's decreasing is because fewer people are getting married.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Point well taken, right? But it is decreasing.
You actually did a brilliant post, by the way. Follow Paul on Instagram because his Instagram's great. Even though it'll give you a kick up the ass with your life because his life he's sorted his life. But you've a couple of days. Actually, you might have even been today. You did 10 ways dating and marriage will change forever. Yeah. Is that today you did that? So can I read a couple of them? That. Nearly all new dates will come from apps online. We just mentioned that. The metaverse will become a popular first date location. That is scary. Governments will strongly advocate for marriage. You think they're going to go back to wanting us to get married? Will they give us tax relief or something? Is that what you think?
Even beyond that. So this is another one I've been tracking closely. If you look at Singapore, if you look at China, if you look at Japan, you look at South Korea, what they're doing right now is, you know, so they're ahead of us a little bit because when I say ahead of us is the birth rate is decreasing all around the world.
Right.
Right. And the number of marriages decreasing, right? The divorce rate is dropping, but marriages. So what does that mean for government? Government looks at that and they say, okay, that means unstable economies.
Okay.
That's because that's all they're thinking. Unstable economy. So they think, how do we stabilize the economy? We need more people being born in marriages. So what you see happening in Singapore, you know, all those areas I just mentioned, is that they're not only increasing the incentives for marriage, but they are starting to incentivize matchmakers. So I am, most of the matchmaker, there are very few matchmakers around the world. There's only, you know, like 300-400. So it's not a massive industry. I know most of the top matchmakers around the world. And for the first time in our industry history, Singapore is funding a matchmaking conference.
Wow.
Matchmaking conference, Singapore. Because they say, hey, we want the best matchmakers in the world to come here, right? To help to put our people together. So absolutely, you're going to see governments, Western governments now trend towards this as well.
I wonder how much a matchmaker is worth. I mean, you know, if you were to say to me, like, Tim, give me 100 grand, but I'm going to give you the most perfect person that you're going to see out your days with and everything else, I'd think, and then you could go, what about 500 grand? Or you could go, what about a grand? And I go, that's too expensive. I don't know. It's a weird one, isn't it? To work out what the value of that is.
That's a brilliant question to ask. How much is a matchmaker worth? I'm going to be thinking about that. That's a brilliant question. I can tell you the highest rate I've seen matchmakers charge. So my mentor, when I started matchmaking, her name was Rachel Greenwald. I'll just put her out there. She went to Harvard. You know, she was like considered to be one of the smartest, you know, matchmakers in the world. In her heyday, she was charging $100,000. But it gets better on the front end.
Wow.
On the front end. And then upon success, another, you know, $50,000, $100,000. So yeah, I mean, some matchmakers can charge quite a pretty penny.
Wow, that's a lot of money. But I suppose if it brings you happiness, though, I suppose the thing is, Paul, and you'll know about this, shouldn't you really be comfortable with yourself first before you try and embark on a relationship? You should, I know it's such a cliche thing, but you should learn to love yourself, because if you can't appreciate yourself, why should you expect somebody else to? Is that a fair point?
Yeah, it's definitely a fair point. The way that I like to look at it is, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Okay.
You know, like, we need shelter, you know, safety, right? We need these things. But if you look at yourself and you realize if you're when you go up the pyramid, self-love is like right in the middle of the pyramid, right? Mm-hmm. If you could get to that point, you can then understand intellectually why it's important to have self-love, because you can't have self-love until you first have a sense of security, right? Unless you first have like some shelter, like you have food and water on a regular basis, right? So then look at the opposite. If you don't have safety, if you are fearing for your life day in and day out, how can you be in love with anyone? Because you're just trying to figure out how to survive.
Yeah.
So it makes sense when you think about that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you realize, okay, if I have all these things, shelter, safety, food, water, blah, 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 and I have self-love, I'm in a better state. I'm in a better place to be able to love. That's not to say that you can't fall in love if you don't have the highest level of self-esteem or self-love, because you can. But that is to say that if you do have your highest level of self-esteem and self-love, you can then have a better relationship, right, with someone else.
Interesting. And I ended up reading a lot of, I don't know if you know this, Paul, but I had depression quite badly. One of the reasons why I started this podcast. And so I've done lots of reading, a lot of bloody reading. And one of the things which really hit me with the self-love thing was I started reading the Stoics. I wrote about Stoicism. And one of the things they said, and I can't remember which one it was, said, if you desire what you have, not what you want, you'll have a much happier life. And that actually helps you do the self-love thing. And I have to, by the way, I have to constantly remind myself about that, because I was looking in the mirror and I go, oh, Christ, I'm losing my hair. And, you know, I'm not as pretty as I used to be. And then go, hold on a second, but I'm still walking around on two legs. I can still do a cartwheel. You know, I can still kick a football about, you know, I've got a job. You know, I've got a house. And so you start desiring what you actually have, then you can start going, actually, it's not so bad. And the opposite to that, as I discuss on podcasts a lot, when you're desiring something else, like Jeff Bezos, I always use this as an example. I desire his money and you know what he's created, but you can't just cherry pick what you desire. You have to have the whole of Jeff Bezos. So you have to have his face and his life, and you have to have the fact that he's spending all his time working out because he's clearly got some issues there, and you know, it's like you have to have the whole package, and I think that's the way to do it.
Shade.
get up every day and desire what you have, not what you want, and I think that helps you with the self-love and maybe stop you lying on apps, maybe.
On that, all right. So Tim, I got two things on that, Tim. Okay, two things on that. Stoicism also changed my life. It did. I'm a big believer in all the Stoics, you know, read everything from Seneca. Like, I think that is something that we all should do. And yeah, we all will derive, self-love and self-worth, right, mm-hmm, from that. And then also to your point of Jeff Bezos, it's fascinating because I was just talking about him like last week. And I was saying how, you know, if you look at Jeff Bezos pre-Amazon, right, when he was starting Amazon, when he was married, when he was just launching, go Google photos of him. Hmm. You know what? He looks happy. He's always smiling. Really. He doesn't have the muscles. He doesn't have the money, right? He was always happy-go-lucky. If you watch videos of Jeff Bezos starting Amazon, people called him nerdy, geeky, but he was happy. You could see light in his eyes. Look at Jeffrey Bezos today. Look at him. Mm. You just described him, right? I have not seen this guy smile. I have not seen, he's puttering around with, the person who looks like the trophy girlfriend, you know, on the mega yacht. Yes, he vacillates between wealthiest person in the world, second wealthiest person in the world, right? But I bet you go in and you really find out, is this dude happy? Nah.
Yeah.
Nah. You know what I mean? And so point well taken. It's like exactly what you said, is that we have to figure out happiness for ourselves. And the beauty is that it lives in our mind. We can conjure that up, you know, and we can conjure that up through Stoicism, right? And through the appreciation of what we do have and what we can still do with the time that we have.
Do you know what the thing about Jeff Bezos is that I always think, I can't get my head around, is the fact that all his staff hate him, apart from obviously the top of the pyramid, and the general public don't like him either. And I thought, you know, we don't like the fact they tax dodge and the way they operate. And you just think, if he spent as much time on making his staff feel great, I can't believe you'd have all that money and all that power and the yachts and everything else, and you wouldn't go, Why don't I just give all my staff a pay rise, give them all a living wage, maybe give them some health insurance in America, you know, and make them like so it's the best place on earth to work. And then I might not be the second richest person in the world, or as you say, between the first and the second, I might only be the 20th. However, my staff love me and everyone wants to work for Amazon and we're creating something in the world. Why doesn't he think like that? And I just can't get my head around it at all.
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what. So I wrote an article like maybe 8-9 years ago. So one of my jobs was I was a columnist for USA Today, business columnist for USA Today. And I wrote an article called 20 things I learned working, 20 things I learned working for two billionaires. Cause I worked for two billionaires, Oprah for 3 years. And I worked for another billionaire named Enver Yücel for 5 years. And because of that article, I then did a full series for USA Today where I interviewed billionaires. So at one point, I had interviewed more billionaires than any other journalist, right? Interviewed tons and tons of billionaires. And I'll tell you my thought as to why you would not see Jeffrey Bezos or another billionaire doing that is because power and money then begets the desire for more power and for more money. And ultimately, even though he's the wealthiest or second wealthiest guy in the world, what he's calculating is how can I become wealthier? Right. You think about that. That's how capitalism works. You know, it is, I need to figure out how I can reduce all of my expenses. And the biggest expense line in a company is salary. Yeah. Right. So I need to figure out how am I going to squeeze everyone? How am I going to overcharge you so I could take that margin and I could take that and put that in my pocket? And I need to keep doing that. I need to keep doing that. And the more of this money that I see, the more that I want. It's a drug, you know? A lot of these men are just counting coins. You know, that's what it is.
Could I recommend a book to you, I've interviewed him on this podcast and he's fantastic. A guy called Will Storr wrote a book called The Status Game. And in it, he says money and power are good, but status outshines them all. And he talks constantly, gives example after example after example about where's the status of this person. I imagine that's what you're talking about with the Billionaires Club. You know, we've got status in our local pub or in our industry, in the TV industry or something. We're searching for our status. The billionaires are all looking for the status, where they belong, who's got the best private jet, who's got the best yacht, and it's just a stupid status game being played out by humans constantly, because that's how we get our worth in life.
Yeah. You know what? Okay. I'm going to read that book.
Oh, it's a great book.
I'm going to read it. Yeah. Thank you. And I see that. You know, I see that too, you know, in the TV industry, you know, among, you know, quote unquote celebs, you know, I see it. And what's so sad about it is that you could see how a lot of people will sacrifice even loved ones. They'll sacrifice their happiness and their satisfaction just for that. I was going to call it status. I would say status, but status. You know, they sacrifice it all just for that. And that's why I try to distance myself. It's like I've got one foot in TV land, but I try to always keep one foot out of it for that exact reason, not to get caught up in that. That's the reason why I don't go to, you know, parties or like events. I don't like to do that because of that reason.
Yeah, I mean, I spent years going, why am I being overlooked? And now I look at my career and I think I've been on TV every week for 27 years. It's been amazing. It's been an amazing career. But I look back and go, why not on Saturday? Why haven't I broken America? All that sort of stuff. And now, let's move on. I think we've only managed to ask two questions, but let's go on to the next one because it's a good one. What does success mean to you, Paul?
Oh man, this is exactly what we're talking about. This is a great segue. Great segue.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think we have to define what that is for ourselves. And if you can't define it for yourself, you'll never be successful. Never. Okay. If you cannot define it for yourself. So for me, it is about knowing what my values are: family, financial freedom, culture, legacy, and then feeding those things, which is why we go on the road trips, which is why, you know, I opt out of the parties to instead go pick up my boys from school, you know, which is, you know, as long as, so for me, remember, we have to define it for ourselves.
Yeah.
For me, success is knowing my values and then every day, you know, being able to feed those values. And as long as I'm doing that, I feel like I'm successful.
Yeah, I tell you, we're speaking the same language again. It's really weird because on my journey, let's call it, trying to sort out why I was depressed, one of the things I realized is that I had to have a fundamental base of what my values were. And then I started looking at my values and I realized that sometimes I wasn't living my life to my values and it made me really unhappy. But the the weird side of it is that I worked in football for a long time, but football does not fit my values. So I really struggle with it. Look at the Premier League and the gross amount of money being spent. Look at my football club, Chelsea, where the money came from the Russian guy. I knew it was bad. And so I struggled with it. And then you look at the way that every time there's no success from a Chelsea manager, he was sacked. And it was like, this doesn't fit my values. I'm supposed to be supporting and being empathetic and this constant. So it's a really tough thing when you start realizing your values are one thing and then you look at something that you really like and it doesn't fit them. You're like, oh, hold on a second. So I've kind of removed myself from that. I still watch football and I still enjoy it, but I'm not as passionate as I was about it.
You know, and you're not overly consumed. I think what you just said actually is the magic that a lot of people miss. And that is, what you did is you took an assessment, like an inventory of what you consume, and you then made a conscious decision that you were going to stop consuming the bad stuff and consume more of the good stuff, right? The stuff that you feel good.
Yeah.
I find that to be the case with so many people who, you know, so for me, I haven't stepped into depression, but I do suffer from anxiety. And I have terrible, terrible anxiety. And I've noticed that a lot of what brings it on for me is in consuming bad stuff. It could just simply be consuming bad content on Instagram. Like it could be listening to like what I consider to be, you know, not great music. You know what I mean? Bad music in terms of the lyricism. And the moment that I'm able to then disproportionately consume the good stuff, right? Then all of a sudden, you know, I'm in a different light. So I think that's just a really important point that you made about how you changed, you took control over your life, you know, and it shows that we can.
Still work in progress though. And I have to say it's hard work. Like going to the gym, this is what I believe, like going to the gym, which I try and do regularly or exercise regularly, I try and do something every day. And it's hard work. Sometimes you don't want to do it, but that's also, I believe, what I have to do with my mental, to constantly read, like I'm sure you do, you know, try and meditate, try and do things. It's a constant work in progress. You can't stop, because if you do stop, and sometimes I do, you slowly slip back into your old ways. And I start going online and start looking at crap and trash. And then you're right. I get that sort of feeling of misery rather than looking at uplifting and exciting things.
It's a slippery slope. And
nourishing things.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind. But not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available, and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback, with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot, based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.
What's the key to a successful marriage?
Oh my God. I mean, this is one I could talk for a couple of hours on, but I'd say that for me and Jay, Jill, my wife, is time together, right? And that's not just us, but that's also me, you know, intellectually looking at couples and us, you know, being counselors, etc. Is that I've noticed that time is a major factor in whether or not two people grow together, or just grow apart, or just kind of grow in tandem but not together. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So if you think about time, and I'm talking about quality time, and I'm not talking about the love language quality time, but having dialogue and interactions and knowing the ups and downs of someone's day, knowing the goals that someone has, right? Knowing that you're trying to achieve something in particular together, right? To have that time together, whether that time is for, you know, a road trip, whether the time is a date, right? But time. And it seems so non 2022 to talk about time, because we're all about efficiency. Like, oh, can't we just zoom? No. It's about time. Time on task, right? And so I think that really is the quote unquote secret, if you will, right? But I think it's about time. And then the other part about time is time allows you to have the communication to resolve challenges, right? And so you can't resolve it if you don't have the time. Time to me is everything. Is everything.
Yeah. The only problem with marriage is, as far as I can see, relationships, is if the people are pulling in separate directions. Not the only problem, but one of the problems is the pulling. So you could go to Jill, you know, let's go traveling. Let's take the boys and travel around the UK and see all the sights and up to Scotland and everything else. And she's going, do you know what? I'd quite like to go and lie on the beach in the Seychelles, you know. And that's where it comes unstuck. So you've got to find a like-minded person, haven't you?
Well, yeah. So you're talking about, I think, the most important, and that is how to choose. It's interesting. This is I'm working on a project right now called How to Choose a Partner Wisely.
Right.
And the whole notion is exactly what you're saying. So I think that most of us choose unwisely, right? We choose bad partners. And if you're in a relationship with a bad partner, there's no amount of time together that's going to rectify that, you know? But so the key is you first need to choose not just any partner, but the right partner for you. And all of the research shows that when you choose the right partner, you live longer, you're happier, you're physically healthier, you make more money, right? Your children are in a stronger position because you're happy. Like, all of these things add up to being, you know, to feeling, you know, like you're a better human, but it starts with choosing the right partner. So absolutely, that's where it begins and technically ends.
Someone once told me the way to find a right partner is you're not supposed to sleep with them till you've gone through four seasons, 12 months. I mean, you're allowed to kiss and cuddle, but you're not allowed to actually have sex with them and swap and get the you know, all the fluids going, and you know, get your hormones going, and that way you can actually tell whether you like someone properly if they're a life partner. And I just thought that is just an impossibility in this modern day and age. What do you think of that?
It does happen, right? People are able to hold back. I had a conversation with a woman yesterday who was telling me about how she fell in love with this guy. They had sex the first night. And like, he doesn't want to see her. And I said, well, you know, holding back from sex is a great litmus test on whether or not someone is interested in short or long-term dating. Right. So that's really what holding back does. It doesn't necessarily mean they're the right person. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to go on to, but it distinguishes two very important categories. And this is something that we need to know in terms of modern day dating, is that in modern day dating, we date either for short term or for long term. Long term is, doesn't necessarily mean marriage, but it does mean, hey, we're going to be committed for a long period of time, you know, years situation. Short term is typically, I'm just looking for casual sex, or I'm looking for someone to just chill with for 4 or 6 weeks or for the summer, mm-hmm. right? So the issue that a lot of us run into is that we may be long-term wanting short-term, or we may be short-term, right? And we get into a relationship with somebody who wants long-term. So a great distinguishing factor to those two is how quickly they desire to have sex. Someone who wants a short-term relationship will not wait a long period of time to have sex with someone. So that is a great litmus test just to distinguish the two categories, right? But then there's many, if you want a great partner, then there's many other things that you want to look at to determine if they're a great partner.
Is it healthy? Can you get nourishment out of just having short-term sexual relationships with people?
I mean, can you get nourishment? What does nourishment mean? Tell me, what does nourishment mean to you, Tim?
All right. Well, is it mentally healthy to do that, do you think?
Mentally healthy, you'd have to break that down, right? Part of mentally healthy is reducing stress. Does sex reduce stress? Absolutely. But do you also form a connection to that person through, you're talking about the dopamine and everything? Absolutely. You do form a connection. There's not one sexologist that I've talked to that's ever said that there is not a bond that's formed through sex. However, you can be someone who is just looking for a short term, and that's fine for you. You could be someone who's considered the dark triad, right? You heard about this?
No.
Like the psychopaths, the Machiavellians,
right.
So you could be in that category. And if you're in that category, then, you know, quick sex is fine for you. You could be in a scenario where you have evolved, because there are people I feel who have evolved to a point where they can understand and distinguish between, this is short-term sex. We plan to have no long-term relationship. There's a lot of sex workers are in that position where they're able to put themselves in a state where they say, okay, you know what? This is my job. This is a short term. Although most studies do show that most sex workers have like the same clients year after year after year, right? And the reason for that is because a bond is formed. But there are people I think that can categorize. So it's like, it's not a yes, no, I don't think. I believe that you can, most people can't.
I just realized that when you were just discussing that there's one of the biggest problems with relationships is the huge desire we have. So, you know, I'm an older man, and years ago you would get hold of a girlfriend. Get hold, that's not a very nice expression, is it? You'd meet a lovely lady and you'd start dating. There's no way you'd muck that up because it was so hard to get her in the first place, because you had to actually bother to go and ask her and then get the phone number and do all that sort of stuff. Now it's very easy. It's very transactional because it's like a swipe left, swipe right, that sort of thing. And we've got huge amounts of porn now because of iPads and everything else that you can just, and it's free. So there's all this desire of, you know, again, if you wanted to look at porn, you had to go to a shop and buy it, or go to a park bench or something. I don't know where the porn magazines were. The desire for different sexual partners must be putting real stress on relationships, or variety even.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. And you just, you know, drop porn. Porn is hands down changing how we interact with each other and why we interact. I actually just finished a study that I did with Trojan here in the UK. And we
looked at the condom people, yeah?
The condom people. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true, because they're big in the US.
Yeah.
But we specifically looked at pornography and the impact that pornography has. And the overwhelming majority of the respondents said that there's a negative outpouring. But unfortunately, what's happening is that 18 to 24-year-old category is the one that is being able to, they're learning about sex through pornography, but they're also learning about relationships through pornography. Versus if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, you learned about relationships through a different lens. Mm. It was slower. It was more, you know, genteel, you know what I mean? But when your whole experience of a relationship is watching a man choke out a woman, you know, during sex, that becomes your standard.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, but long story short is, it's a real problem. Like, it is a real problem. And to even go deeper here in the UK, you know, if you look at the assault on women, you know, sexual, physical assaults on women here is just on the rise and is just, you know, it's just sad. And I think a lot of it has to do with how we learn about relationships, and a lot of how we learn about relationships is through pornography.
Do you know what? I was interviewed John Ronson on this podcast, and he'd done, I was desperately just searching for it there. I can't find it. He did a podcast on the porn industry, and I can't remember what it's called. Oh, The Butterfly Effect. That's it. The Butterfly Effect is brilliant.
Okay.
A really interesting look. But the bit which is so poignant for me is they've got a woman on the, a naked woman. He's on a porn shoot, and she's going to, all these men are going to, come all over or something. I'm not one of those sort of type scenarios. And there's a naked woman there, and there's a long line of men queuing up. And to get aroused, they've all got tablets and mobile phones and things, and watching porn rather than the naked woman in front of them. And I was like, that is absolutely incredible. That is now more exciting for a man than the actual thing in front of you. Incredible.
The thing in front of you. Yeah. I mean, wow. I'm gonna tell that story. That's
incredible. Yeah. When I say the thing, sorry, I meant the thing as in the porn shoot, the thing going on, which is supposed to be exciting for them, which is why they indulge in the porn. I will try not to call the woman a thing. Apologies for that, because it came across terribly. Right. We've asked so many few questions. I'm going to go really left field here, because it's my favorite question I ask everybody. And I'm going to ask you, have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO? I haven't, by the way, and I'm desperate to, but have you seen them?
Oh, man. Okay. This is a good one. Okay. I'm going to say, I believe I have.
What? Yes. Excellent. Where? Ghost or UFO?
A UFO.
Right. Where?
I believe I have. I will say, all right. I didn't know we were going to go here, but, I mean, UFOs, it's an unidentified flying object. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I think I believe that life exists outside of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think if you believe, like me, that life exists outside of Earth, then without a shadow of a doubt, there will be UFOs. Right. And that doesn't mean, you know, green men riding rocket ships around, you know, around the skies. It just means that debris, etc. But for me, yes. So
you did see one?
I believe so. Yeah.
Where?
Yeah, I do. This is many times. Many times. I'm talking about. So in the U.S., I lived in. I was born in New York, but I lived in Washington, D.C.
Right.
In Washington, D.C., you have the Pentagon, right? You have all these major, you know, like defense areas. And so you'd periodically see, like you'd hear, okay, the airspace is being closed. Because anytime the president flies in, which is often, or a head of state, they close off the airspace, right? Mm-hmm. So no airspace, no flying around in a particular area. But occasionally, you'd see some, like, I'd see wild things, you know, in the sky. Also, my family lived in Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah. And if you know anything about Utah, it's big freaking mountains. And this is where some of the best skiing is in the United States. And so my brother and I would ski often. And, you know, you'd get up there and you'd see, you know, you'd see things that you consider to be like abnormal. Now, could it be, you know, a weird hybrid of bird flying around? Like, could it be the, you know, a defense company testing a new drone? Like, could it be those things? It could be, but also it might not be.
Hmm. When you say wild things, is that, what do you see? Just like objects in the sky when you say that?
Yeah, objects.
Salt Lake City's in Utah, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. That's where they live, Salt Lake City.
So I drove through, I was doing that driveway thing, and one of the headlights in the car had gone out, and I was driving through and the police pulled me over, and being British, I got out of the car. Oh, geez, it was a nighttime, right? And they put a light on me. And they both had cowboy hats on, right? Those sort of cowboy hat things. And they got out rifles, like guns. And they pointed at me and on a loudspeaker and went, "Get back in the car." And I was like, "Holy shit, they've got guns. What are they doing? Why?" Because you're so not used to seeing people with guns in Britain. And I was like, "British," my hands in the air, British. Yeah. They go, "Get back in the car." I was terrified because I'd never had a gun pointed at me before. It's just such a normal thing in America. And Christ, I was so scared. I can't tell you that feeling of having someone point a gun at you. It's terrifying. And it's so normal for Americans to think that's just acceptable, that someone might point a gun at them. It's mental. So,
Oh my God. I mean, and not to go, you know, way left with the conversation, but not only if I had, you know, a gun pointed at me, but in places like Florida, where they have the, you know, stand your ground law.
Yeah.
If you step 1 foot into someone's yard, you know, they're where they live, you know, they're, even if their property's not fenced, right, you know, just within their area, they have the right to shoot you.
Jesus Christ.
they have the right to shoot you. So it's to the point where, I mean, it is horrendous, to the point where when I visit, you know, so this is where my parents live. When I visit my parents will say, "Please don't go running. You know, don't run.
Oh my God.
Don't take the bikes out, you know, the bicycles out, with the boys, with the grandkids, because if you're riding along and you just accidentally fall into someone's yard, they could blow you away.
Oh my God.
Not serve one day in prison. Like, it's just crazy.
It is crazy. But I got to say, I do love America. And so, you know, it's for all its downsides, I don't want to get too miserable on it. By the way, just going back to your UFO, we're coming to the end of the conversation. Thank you so much. But I'm going back to the UFO. Do you think Barack Obama's a good guy? Because I do.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's smart. Yeah. I don't think he's a liar. He was on James Corden and he said, and I cannot believe more people haven't made, this is only about 6 months ago, I cannot believe people haven't made more of this. He was on James Corden. He said, "There's definitely UFOs and we have no idea what they are. I'm not saying they're aliens, but there's definitely unidentified flying objects going around the skies." Yeah. This is the ex-president of the United States of America saying this. I don't know why it's not front page of everything constantly, right? And so if it's not, I mean, it could be multiverse, right? That's one of the things. It could be aliens, or it could be the Chinese or the Russians or something. If it's the Chinese or Russians, we need to find out about it right now. Why is this not front page of everything? I find it so astonishing that, and when I bring it up, people always think I'm a lunatic. I'm like, even Barack Obama said it.
That's why when you asked me the question, I was like, "Oh, do I want to say?" Because everyone's going to think. But it's my truth. It's like, absolutely.
Right.
I think that, you know, to that point of, if you have the president of the United, I didn't realize he said that, but you have the president of the United States who gets intel briefings.
Yeah.
To this day, he still gets intel briefings, right?
Yeah.
He has access to the top technology in the world. If he is saying that there are UFOs, who is anyone to refute that?
Yeah.
You can't refute it.
But for anyone who doesn't believe me, look up online. It's just him on a chat show, James Corden's chat show in America, discussing it. And I just thought, this is it. This is where everyone takes it seriously and no one does. And I was like, and I think it's that thing of you pausing, going, are people going to think I'm a lunatic here? But there's definitely something happening, whether it is UFOs or it could be birds, as you say, or it could be funny things going on with the weather. Who knows? But there's a lot of US naval people and Air Force people coming out now and saying we've seen it on radars and stuff like that. But
pilots.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. A final question, Paul. Thank you so much for joining me today. But what is the meaning of life? Nice, easy one at the end.
Oh man, yeah, nice, smooth one. Oh man, all right. So of course I'm gonna go real philosophical and say, you know, you have to determine that. But I think that if you could figure out what is the meaning before your life has ended, then you've lived a, you know, you've lived a good one. Mm. Because this is a crazy way to go out, but it is what it is. Is about 5 years ago, my best friend, day one friends, he passed away. Mm-hmm. And what I find so discomforting about him passing away is that A, I know he wasn't happy. He wasn't happy with his life. You know, he was single. He wanted to be married. He talked all the time about having kids. He wasn't happy in his career. He felt like he was overweight. He wanted to lose weight. Like he didn't have the finances that he wanted. I know. I talked to him every day, right? I know he wasn't happy. And I know he would always question, well, what's the point? What's the point? What's the point of all this? What's the point of all this? And then he dies. And it was a terrible accident. So he didn't mean to die, but he dies. It's this terrible accident. And here I am left saying, my God, he left disgruntled. He left not knowing why was he even supposed to be here. That to me is the most painful thing in the world, right? So to your question, I think if we can just figure out why, like why we are here, what is the point? Like then that at least means that there's meaning, you know, to why we're here. So I think it's a brilliant question. And also, you know, I think that's the brilliance of, you know, this podcast is that we're talking about humanity on this. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we just had a conversation about humanity and living. And so I think if more people are participating in the dialogue around humanity, it can help to then maybe, you know, spotlight the why. And then they can answer your question.
Brilliant. Do you know what? I could talk to you all day. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's been fantastic. So I hope you've enjoyed it too.
I have as well. This is, yeah. I tell you what, I've never been asked. I've never talked about pornography, UFOs, and Donald Trump in one conversation.
It's all there. Brilliant. I recommend everyone follows Paul and Paul C. Brunson on Instagram. That's probably the best place, is it? That's where I follow you. I get all my information about you there. So
that's good. I do my business stuff on LinkedIn, and I do my, you know, humanity stuff on Instagram.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining me, Paul. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.